George Gershwin's Porgy and Bess opens with the song Summertime, and really, what more need be said? The song has the viscosity of a South Carolina summer. It radiates heat. It's musically complex and astonishingly simple, beautiful, languorous, and evocative. I could ask how Gershwin accomplishes all that, but that sounds like work. And in this heat, who has the energy? Better to find a seat on the porch, a cold drink, and just enjoy the music. That Porgy and Bess tempts us to do this is one measure of its greatness. We can appreciate it without analysis. But we can enjoy it even more if we understand how it works. Any work of art is many things, but one of them is a construction, a mechanism. An engineer will tell you that the way to understand a mechanism is to take it apart and put it back together. The same is true of music. The only difference with musicology in general, and Porgy and Bess in particular, is that when we disassemble a piece of music, we often become so fascinated by the parts that we forget to reassemble it. There are excellent reasons to disassemble Gershwin's opera. Premiered on Broadway in 1935 with an all-black cast, based on a best-selling novel by a white Southern author whose great-great-great-grandfather was a slave owner who signed the Declaration of Independence, overflowing with songs that 80 years later remain among the most recognizable American tunes ever written, Porgy and Bess is a miraculous mechanism. Where does it fit in the consuming question of race in America? Is it an opera? Is it a musical? What did it mean in 1935? Was it groundbreaking or reactionary? What are the larger themes of the piece and how do they speak to us today? The pieces of the opera are fascinating and lead us to a series of what-ifs. If George Gershwin had not died of a brain tumor at the age of 38, if American opera companies and audiences were not insecure about the cultural importance of American music, if slavery had not existed to make race the defining issue of American history and by its enormity crowded out lesser discussions, if World War II had not crashed over the European continent a mere 4 years after Porgy's premiere. In short, if the maelstrom of history had not caught Porgy in its vortex, Gershwin's masterpiece might have been the model for a succession of popular American operas. It might have been an Orfeo, a Die Freischütz, a Tristan und Isolde. In this case, establishing what it means for an opera to be American. Why? Because when we reassemble Porgy and Bess, I believe we discover that Gershwin's masterpiece is not just an opera, but the American opera. My name is Nicholas Ivor Martin. I'm the Director of Operations of Lyric Opera of Chicago, and I'd like to speak to you about George Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. The excerpts you will hear are from a Warner Classics recording featuring Willard White as Porgy, Cynthia Hayman as Bess, Harolyn Blackwell as Clara, Damon Evans as Sporting Life, and Greg Baker as Crown. Simon Rattle conducts the London Philharmonic and the Glyndebourne Chorus. The original sound recordings of musical excerpts are used by permission of Warner Classics. We cannot talk about Porgy and Bess without talking about race. Gershwin himself was a white New Yorker, and he based his opera on the best-selling novel Porgy, written by white South Carolina author DuBose Hayward. Some people argue that Gershwin and Hayward had no business writing an opera about the experience of Southern blacks. Writing around the time of the premiere, composer Virgil Thompson asserted that Porgy was, quote, a libretto that should never have been accepted, on a subject that never should have been chosen, by a man who should never have attempted it. Folklore subjects recounted by an outsider are only valid as long as the folk in question is unable to speak for itself, unquote. Author James Baldwin agreed with Thompson, writing that Porgy and Bess is, quote, a white man's vision of Negro life, unquote. But his objection went deeper, saying that Gershwin trivialized race by using it to provide an exotic background to his opera. In Baldwin's words, this means that when the opera should be most concrete and searching, it veers off into the melodramatic and the exotic. It seems to me that the author knew more about Bess than he understood, and more about Porgy than he could face, than any of us so far can face. Baldwin feared that if Catfish Row is a charming place to live, as he put it, then blacks will, quote, remain in Catfish Row to have fish fries and make love. It is a fantasy which is tearing the nation to pieces, and it is surely time we snapped out of it, unquote. Questions were still being asked about Porgy and Bess 50 years after its premiere. In 1985, when the Metropolitan Opera asked Grace Bunbury to take on the role of Bess for the company's first performance of the work, the singer was reluctant. "I thought it beneath me," she explained. "I felt I had worked far too hard, that we had come far too far to have to retrogress to 1935. A white composer, a black author, and a black singer questioning the piece's appropriateness, its accuracy, its intentions, and its relevance. I mention these objections now because the discussion of race in Porgy is front and center from the work's first notes. After an instrumental introduction that is often cut in performance, Porgy opens with Clara's Summertime, an oddly sultry lullaby she sings to her baby. Clara's husband follows Summertime with his own satirical lullaby, A Woman is a Sometime Thing. The setting is Catfish Row, a fictional seaside location in South Carolina. It is Saturday evening and the men of the row relax by gambling. Their craps game is organized by Porgy, a cripple who uses a goat cart both as a means of transportation and as a way of eliciting sympathy when he goes begging. The last to join the game is Crown, a powerful, brutal longshoreman. Crown buys whiskey and happy dust, cocaine, from the local dealer, Sporting Life. Bess is Crown's woman, a drunk and an addict who is shunned by the respectable women of Catfish Row. When Crown loses at craps, he starts a fight with the winner and kills him with a discarded cotton hook. The residents, including Crown, scatter to avoid a confrontation with the police. Sporting Life offers to take Bess to New York with him, but she refuses, and the first scene ends with the abandoned Bess begging for shelter and being refused until Porgy takes her in. This is not an uplifting depiction of black American life. The inhabitants of Catfish Row are poor, sensuous, uneducated, and violent. They are also racist, a point that modern productions often conveniently forget. It's easy to explain why the respectable inhabitants of the row loathe and shun Sporting Life. He's a drug dealer. But they have another reason. Hayward's novel makes clear that Sporting Life is a so-called octroon, a person with a single black great-grandparent. In the Old South, this is more than enough to unleash on him all the horrors of white racism. But the fact that he appears white also makes him anathema in the black community, a traitor by birth. And he's on his way north to New York, about which more later. Can we answer the accusation that Porgy is tone-deaf on the issue of race? Thompson's criticism is the easiest to answer, and not simply because as a white man he was not himself a victim of racial prejudice. That composer's central assertion is that the actual opera is irrelevant. Hayward and Gershwin had no business trying to tell a story about Southern blacks. It doesn't matter what they wrote. We are free to accept his premise, many people do, but it has the unfortunate side effect of erasing much of our shared cultural heritage. Tolstoy had no business writing Anna Karenina, he was not a woman. Shakespeare should not have written Merchant of Venice, as far as we know he wasn't Jewish, and Robert Louis Stevenson was misguided to have penned Treasure Island, he wasn't a pirate. Thompson wrote his own opera for an all-black cast, Four Saints in Three Acts. But precisely because that opera does not relate to the black experience, it is hard not to see his casting choice as either a political statement, if you think he made a good choice, or a gimmick, if you don't. When Bunbury accepted the role of Bess and learned the score, it changed her mind. She realized she had, quote, gone from reluctance to acceptance to gung-ho, unquote. James Baldwin was also enthusiastic about the opera in spite of his criticisms. "I like Porgy and Bess," he wrote. Hayward, he explained, was not inventing all this, but describing things that he had seen. That Gershwin and Hayward saw race as adding an element of exoticism to Porgy is unquestionable. When he began work on the opera, Gershwin said, "If I am successful, Porgy will resemble a combination of the drama and romance of Carmen and the beauty of Meistersinger." The criticisms of Porgy, then, are not artistic or even largely textual, but rather political. Race is too important an issue in American life merely to provide a backdrop for some opera. What many black performers and thinkers have concluded is that it did and continues to do much more. Gershwin insisted at the time, and the Gershwin estate continues to insist to this day, on an all-black cast. In 1935, this meant that blackface was unacceptable. Less offensive alternatives, colorblind casting or using other performers of color, have found no more favor with the Gershwin family. The result at the time was that Porgy forced open color restrictions in theaters where it was performed. When Porgy was premiered at the National Theater in Washington, D.C. in 1935, a protest by the cast convinced the theater management to admit black audience members, at least for performances of Porgy. National allowed black performers but banned blacks from buying tickets. Constitution Hall across town allowed blacks in the audience but banned them from performing on stage. The piece promoted the careers of black singers, something with a cost for singers who felt that Porgy did not lead to more mainstream operatic roles. The fundamental basis for criticisms of Porgy and Bess, that the piece should be an instrument in the long fight for civil rights in America, is an enormous burden to put on a theatrical work. If Porgy was not considered a work of genius, it would not, of course, have mattered if it fell short on this point. Premiered in 1935, Porgy portrays black Americans as tragic human figures in a way that resonates almost a century later. When people were not arguing about race in Porgy and Bess, they were obsessed by whether it was an opera or a musical. I mentioned that there is music before Clara sings Summertime that is usually cut. Gershwin's score starts with a piano performance by Jazz Bo Brown, a semi-legendary Delta blues musician. Gershwin spells Jasbo J-A-S-B-O because he read a poem about the musician by Dubose Hayward. In other references to the blues musician, Jasbo is sometimes spelled J-A-Z-Z, Jazz, B-O, on the theory that he gave his name to that unique American genre. Gershwin was a rare type in American music, famous equally in the classical concert hall and in the more popular music forms of his day. He learned his craft working as a song plugger on Tin Pan Alley, a pianist who played music for potential customers of sheet music. By opening Porgy with a blues piano, he made clear to his audience that he meant to fuse popular American musical forms into his new opera. The second scene of Porgy extends the use of American musical forms. The inhabitants of Catfish Row are attending a wake for Robbins, the man Crown killed. The widow is hoping the mourners will contribute enough to pay for Robin's funeral, and they commemorate the dead man by singing a spiritual. Their prayers are interrupted by a threatening white policeman who says that if the body is not buried soon, it will be given to medical students for dissection. After he is gone, Bess, who has moved in with Porgy in Crown's absence, leads the mourners in a gospel prayer. This is, "We're leaving for the promised land." The lyrics explain that the heavenly train is in the station, a metaphor extended by the music, which mimics the sound of an actual train. Porgy almost had its premiere at the Metropolitan Opera in 1935. Gershwin knew the then board chairman, Otto Kahn, and they discussed the possibility. But Kahn could only offer a meager two performances, so Porgy instead had a private concert premiere at Carnegie Hall, followed by a Broadway opening at the Alvin Theater. The Carnegie version was in three acts and ran to 4 hours. In the three-act version, Robin's funeral ends Act One. The more compact two-act version done by Lyric continues with life returning to normal in Catfish Row. Clara's husband Jake is a fisherman, and he prepares to go to sea in spite of his wife's warnings that it is time for the annual storms. "We need the money," he answers. Porgy sings his ecstatic ballad about his happiness now that he and Bess are together. "I got plenty of nothing," he sings, "and nothing's plenty for me.
Plenty of nothing, and nothing's plenty for me. I got no car, I got no mule, I got no misery. The folks with plenty of plenty got a lock on the door. Afraid somebody's going to rob him while he's out making more. What for?
Banjo songs originated among slaves in the South, but the banjo song came to be recognized as an American popular form. Songwriters such as Stephen Foster wrote them, as did white performers who would sometimes don blackface in performance. This latter use would leave an indelible stain in the history of the minstrel performer in America. We should not confuse this with the odd English patois of the words to Porgy's most famous ballad. I got plenty of nuttin'. It's not, as we say, the King's English, but neither is it meant to demean or parody the residents of Catfish Row. Porgy is set near Charleston, South Carolina, specifically on a group of islands that surround Charleston Harbor. These islands, along with other remote areas along the coasts of North and South Carolina and Georgia, were home to a black population that established its own language and culture. The so-called Gula spoke a Creole language that mixed English words with vocabulary taken from multiple West and Central African languages. As a South Carolina native, Hayward heard Gula spoken from a young age, strengthened by his mother's passionate interest in the language and culture. In his novel, he mimicked the sounds and grammar of the Gula language, to a point that made some of the Gula lines in the novel almost unreadable. The residents of Catfish Row prepare for a picnic on one of the islands near Charleston, in this case, the fictitious Kittawa Island. It's a boat trip away, so the crippled Porgy will not be accompanying them, but he urges Bess to go without him and have fun. The picnic on Kittawa Island is a riot of dancing and storytelling, featuring African drums and the infamous satirical song, "It Ain't Necessarily So," sung by Sporting Life.
It ain't necessarily so. The Bible, it ain't necessarily so.
When Samuel Goldwyn was casting for his 1959 movie of Porgy and Bess, this song made Sammy Davis Jr. so want the role of Sporting Life that he mobilized his friends to hound Samuel Goldwyn unmercifully. The friends in question were Frank Sinatra, George Burns, and Jack Benny. The story goes that Goldwyn finally dropped by the dressing room of the nightclub at which Davis was appearing to offer him the part. "Mr. Davis, you are Sporting Life," he said. "The part is yours. Now will you get all these guys off my back?" Among Goldwyn's less fortunate choices for the movie was the decision to rewrite substantially Gershwin's symphonic orchestration to make it sound more like a musical. And no doubt it is the fame and infamy of the movie that has also clouded people's understanding of the music of the original opera. As the picnic ends on Kittawa Island, Crown stealthily emerges from the bushes. This is where he has been hiding out, and he grabs Bess and drags her off into the woods. Bess struggles, but ultimately Crown overpowers her, not just physically, but emotionally, leading to the tragedy of the next act. The drama is primal and, well, operatic. But does that make it an opera? American audiences have never been quite sure how to receive composers like Gershwin, what we now call crossover artists. If American audiences are still unsure if Porgy is an opera, Gershwin had no such uncertainty. After he had acquired the rights to Porgy from Hayward, but before he had composed the opera, a Broadway producer approached Hayward about the possibility of commissioning a new Porgy musical starring Al Jolson. Gershwin told Hayward to go ahead. "If you can see your way to making some ready money from Jolson's version," he wrote, "I don't believe that it would hurt a serious operatic version in any way." The idea of reinvigorating the operatic form by incorporating indigenous musical forms is itself ancient. It is, in fact, what has kept opera vibrant for 400 years. In what is now considered the first romantic opera, Carl Maria von Weber incorporated native German folk tunes into his Die Freischütz. Nor did Gershwin accept the premise that what he was doing was a musical because it contained popular songs. It's true that I have written songs for Porgy and Bess, Gershwin wrote. I am not ashamed of writing songs at any time, so long as they are good songs. Songs are entirely within the operatic tradition. Nearly all of Verdi's operas contain what are known as song hits. The same could be said of Porgy and Bess. In addition to Summertime, Porgy contains A Woman is a Sometime Thing, I Got Plenty of Nothing, It Ain't Necessarily So, Bess, You Is My Woman Now, and Leaving for the Promised Land. As Gershwin pointed out, I have used symphonic music to unify entire scenes. It's remarkable, and frankly disheartening, that audiences are still today arguing over whether Porgy and Bess is an opera. But it's largely irrelevant. The orchestral and choral demands of the score are significant. Only opera companies today have the resources to do justice to the music. And if opera academics, administrators, and artists lack confidence in the work, their fears, too, have been overtaken by events. In an age when many opera companies face significant hurdles attracting audiences, an American opera that audiences are lining up to hear cannot be ignored. Act 2 of the two-act version opens with Porgy welcoming back Bess, aware that she has been with Crown. I've touched on the cultural and artistic context in which Porgy premiered, but there is also important historical context. Catfish Row is a fictitious location in South Carolina built on a real foundation. It is not, as modern audiences sometimes imagine, a whole neighborhood. DeBose Hayward modeled his Catfish Row on Cabbage Row, a structure in Charleston that dates to the Revolutionary War. It was an amalgam of three row houses which were used as tenements. Lyric's production of Porgy has a chorus of 48 singers, and when you add the principal singers, the number of people you will see on stage is close to the actual number who inhabited Cabbage Row when Hayward was growing up. The name Cabbage Row derived from the practice of the inhabitants of earning money by selling cabbages and other produce from their windows. Cabbage was not the only item for sale, but using that vegetable in the name was as intentional as Hayward's choice of catfish. Both are cheap foodstuffs essential to poor families. As a bottom-feeding fish, catfish was disdained by well-to-do white Southerners, but it became a staple of Southern black cooking. Hayward had a lifelong interest in the plight of poor blacks, but his ancestors had been Southern aristocrats who supported slavery. His great-great-great-grandfather, Thomas Hayward, signed the Declaration of Independence and the Articles of Confederation, and he owned slaves. By the 1920s, when Hayward was writing, the so-called Great Migration was well underway. Southern blacks were fleeing north in enormous numbers, searching out better economic opportunity than could be found in an impoverished agrarian South. In the year 1920, the number of Americans living in cities equaled those living in rural areas for the first time in the country's history. And that trend would continue throughout Hayward's life, leading to further displacement and dislocation. The novel Porgy opens with a poem by Hayward that reads, "Porgy, Maria, and Bess, Robbins, and Peter, and Crown, life was a three-stringed harp brought from the woods to the town. Marvelous tunes you rang from passion and death and birth, you who had laughed and wept on the warm brown lap of the earth. Now in your untried hands an instrument terrible new is thrust by a master who frowns, demanding strange songs of you. God of the white and black, grant us great hearts on the way, that we may understand until you have learned to play." Although the novel does not end with Porgy going north in search of Bess, the idea was congruent with the broader theme of dislocation. Notice also that whatever his sympathies, Hayward was writing to a white audience. Grant us great hearts on the way, that we may understand until you have learned to play. He's speaking to white Americans, asking them to help displaced and disenfranchised black Americans. The insubstantiality of the world for Southern blacks is given physical form in the next scene. A tremendous storm has broken over Catfish Row, so overpowering that the residents huddle together for shelter. Jake is still out at sea in his fishing boat, and the residents pray for him and for themselves.
Oh,
The cacophony of this scene was intentional. Gershwin spent the summer of 1934 on Folly Island off the Carolina coast. Many of the inhabitants were Gula, and Gershwin used his time there to listen to the inhabitants, attend worship services, and take in the culture. His music weaves together six different prayers and is intended to mimic a gathering he overheard while standing outside the Holy Rollers Church on the island. Crown bursts into the room. He has swum over from Kittawa Island in the midst of the storm, and he laughs at everyone's cowardice and bellows out a bawdy song about a red-headed woman. Clara, during all of this, has kept her eyes on the window, and when she sees Jake's empty boat float by upturned, she rushes out into the storm. Someone has to go after her, but Porgy's disability prevents him, and everyone else is too afraid. Crown has bragged about doing personal battle with God, and he goes out for Clara, saying, "All right, big friend, we're on for another bout." The storm passes, and the residents emerge from hiding, convinced that both Clara and Crown are dead. Sporting Life knows better, and when darkness falls, indeed, Crown sneaks into Porgy's room, intending to abduct Bess. Instead, Porgy draws a knife and kills him. With now another murder in Catfish Row, the police again line up suspects. They do not suspect the cripple Porgy, but they cart him off anyway, thinking he is a material witness. While he is gone, Sporting Life uses Happy Dust to seduce Bess into making the trip with him to New York. The history of opera in America, of race relations, and of urbanization form the setting for Porgy. But Hayward and Gershwin's story reaches further. A porgy is a kind of fish, and the Christian symbolism of fish and fishermen is intentional. Porgy is Adam, Bess, Eve. Sporting Life, the snake, literally hissing during "It Ain't Necessarily So." Porgy is a story of hope and rebirth. Clara's baby is taken in by Bess when Clara is lost to the storm, and Serena inherits the baby when Bess leaves with Sporting Life. The community will provide. Most astonishingly, it is a story of hope. Porgy, who begins life as a cynical introvert, ends with a tragic but glowing hope. A cripple, who cannot even make the trip to Kittawa Island, intends to find his way from Catfish Row to New York. And while we don't quite believe that he will succeed, neither are we, the audience, left without hope. The opera ends with Porgy's return from jail. He learns that Bess is gone. But instead of giving up, he declares his intention to leave Catfish Row and find her. Porgy and Bess is the American opera, a story about race, culture, urbanization, horror, and hope.